Carlos Fuentes has been considered one of Mexico's leading intellectuals for over 50 years now. He served its government in various positions, including as its ambassador to France in the 1970s, and he has written fiction and nonfiction. In fact, 24 novels, including Where the Air is Clear, The Old Gringo, and Happy Families. In his latest novel, Destiny and Desire, A Decapitated Head tells the story of two young friends and the two very different Mexicos they grow up into. It's been translated recently by the great Edith Grossman and published by Random House in America, and I'm very pleased that it brings Carlos Fuentes back to our show today. Hi.
Hello, how are you? Good to hear you.
I'm very pleased that you're there, although I suddenly realized when I said published in America, whenever I've been to Mexico, Mexicans have pointed out that Mexico is also America and also North America.
The whole continent is America, North, South, and Central. We're all Americans. But you appropriated the proper name for yourselves.
Well, yeah, I guess.
An act of imperialism.
A decapitated head is a revolutionary symbol. Were you setting out to write a political novel when you began writing this book?
No, not at all. There are many facets, many levels to this novel. There are dreams, and there's sex, and there's love, there's politics, there's personal feelings. There's many, many things. It's a big novel, long novel, so it has capacity for many things.
Because that's the way you see Mexico?
I think that any novelist sees his country more or less as a complex thing. I just finished Freedom by Franzen, which gives a very complex idea of the United States today.
Well, most people in this country, I'm censoring myself now, most people in this country, when they think of Mexico, think of it as a country that's in real turmoil these days. Is Mexico going through one of its worst periods?
Well, no. It's one of the best and one of the worst. You know, you're talking about crime, which is important. It's a factor in Mexican life. It's not all of Mexican life. We are appalled by what is going on in certain states, four or five states, especially on the border with the United States, because of the drug traffic in which there are two parties. We sell and the United States buys. So it's a problem we should solve together. The guns are bought in the United States. Everybody knows the names of the Mexican criminals, but not of the U.S. criminals, those who cleanse the money and give it to consumers. That we don't know. So there should be really something we can do together in order to cope with this problem. But beyond that, the question is really if we can reach, and this is a worldwide problem, it's very difficult, a solution by which drugs are not penalized, in which you have other solutions which are more humane, more lenient, and to get out of this terrible problem in which so many countries are stuck in. It's not only Mexico.
Now, you write in English for many publications, and
yeah,
Obviously you speak English perfectly. Why have this book translated? If you're going to have a book translated, Edith Grossman, who has translated Mario Vargas Llosa, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Cervantes.
She translated, you know, translating a book takes a lot of time, and if you dedicate yourself to that, you're not going to write your books. You're going to translate yourself, and you're going to take jobs from a good translator. And in any case, English is not my real language. The language of my imagination, of my dreams, my desires, my whole being is the Spanish language. So English is a secondary language for me, as is French or Italian, and I wouldn't write a novel in any of these languages that do not belong to me, to my personality, you see.
Your earlier novel, The Death of Artemio Cruz,
yeah,
also told the story of your narrator's life. He appears in this book. Are we to read anything into that?
Yes, it's an antecedent. You know, Artemio Cruz was a representative of the Industrial Revolution in Mexico. Now, Max Monroy is a representative of a budding techno-informative revolution in the country. He represents technology, he represents information, he sees the politics as backward, and he is a step beyond Artemio Cruz. It's a new generation.
The two main characters in the story, two orphans,
yeah,
Josue and Jericho, or should, yeah, I say Josue?
Josue.
Josue and Jericho.
Yeah.
Growing up in the Mexico of today, what are some of the challenges facing a young person in Mexico today, especially those who aspire to have some higher learning and to go into public service.
Yes, it is difficult. We have the ninis in Mexico. Ni educación ni trabajo. They don't have education, they don't have work. They're not the case of Josué and Jericó, but there are at least 50 million people who are under 30 in Mexico. And the big problem of the country is how to give them work, how to give them a purpose in life, have to not, so that they don't drift off into the criminal gangs where they have money and sex and success, and then they die young. We have to create a new purpose, a new program for development, something comparable to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, a new contract for Mexico. We can't go on as though these were normal times. They are not normal times. So we have to propose something that will attract younger people to help build all the things we haven't done in the last 10, 20, 30 years, which are ports, urban infrastructure, highways, dams, schools, hospitals. We have so much work to do in Mexico. It's a pity that we rely on workers sending money from the United States and a bit on tourism and a bit on oil. And we are not doing the proper work inside Mexico that we should be doing. This will require new political leadership, a renovation of Mexican politics in the near future.
Well, Mexico for many, many years was ruled by one party, the PRI.
That's right.
Yep. And now they were considered a party of the left, although they were all over the place throughout their history.
Oh, yeah.
And now the party that seems to be on the ascendance is PAN, the conservative party that finally actually was allowed to win an election.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that nothing much changes.
No. It's the democracy. The PRI has revolutionary legitimacy, which is very important. It lost it in 1968 when the government attacked students in Tlatelolco Square, and that did not recover legitimacy. It passed on to the right-wing PAN. The PAN has governed very much like the PRI, and it has lost. People don't have any confidence in that party anymore. The left is divided. The PRI is old hat. So I think we're in for a renovation of Mexican politics in the near future. We're going to see something new appear. I don't know exactly what it is. You know, when you're in a moment of transition, you cannot distinguish shapes and names. But I think I know people, I know movements, I know ideas that are moving forward beyond the present stalemate of Mexico.
Jericó goes to work for the government, and
yeah.
Josué goes to work for a multi-billionaire entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Many people will read Carlos Slim into Max Malroy.
Carlos Slim is a very nice man. He's a family man. He has children. He is very No. Max Monroy is another breed. He's a totally fictional character. Let me say that at once, because I know Carlos Slim well, and for no moment is he Carlos Slim. He's Max Monroy. He's a character in a novel.
Both of your main characters are rather secular in their outlook. Of course, they grew up within a Roman Catholic culture, or
yes,
a specifically Mexican version of Roman Catholicism.
The Roman Catholicism that has a lot of Indian antecedents. This was the problem the Spanish faced in Mexico, that Mexico was a very big empire, as the Incas in Peru. So they had an organization, they had big cities, they had politics, they had laws, they had religion. And the intelligence of the Spanish was to mix the Catholic religion with the former pantheistic religion of Mexico. So that's what you get in Mexico, is Catholicism with a lot of pantheism. It's a strange mixture, but it's interesting. It's fascinating for a writer, of course.
Well, is it the reason that this book is kind of magic realism?
That's kind of
died in South America, but it still seems to have some kind of relevance for the Mexican story.
Well, you know, magical realism really belongs to two writers, Carpentier of Cuba and García Márquez of Colombia. This has the roots of Mexican fantastic fiction predate magical realism. If you read a novel like Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo, well, it's a novel where the dead are the protagonists. They talk from the graves. This has nothing to do with magical realism. It is a fantastic vision, as is the case of Antigua Concepción, the old mother who is buried in an unknown cemetery with no name, where the protagonist is thrown by an angel and finds her there, and she speaks to him. But, well, if you want to call it magical realism, I have no objection, but it's really another school that comes before Carpentier and García Márquez invented magical realism.
Well, Mexico does have a long fascination with the Walking Dead. All you have to do is look at a lot of art that grows out of it. And the novel's opening pages are presented under the heading Prelude, A Severed Head.
Yeah.
It's the head of Josue floating in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Mexico, and he tells the story?
He tells the story. It's a story told by a severed head.
He went on a legitimate career path, but he still dies young.
Yes, yes. It's dramatic for the two young people. And it's dramatic for the third character, Miguel Aparecido, who is voluntarily in jail, who happens to be their brother. And he is in jail because he wants to be in jail. He's afraid that if he's not in jail, he'll go out and kill his father, Max Monroy. It's not a very joyful family story. It's not the Hardy family.
And then you also have Father Philip Potter.
Yeah. He's a character in another novel I haven't published that happens in Colombia, and he is the mentor of one of the actual guerrillas, Carlos Pizarro, who was killed, murdered on an airplane, and who went to the Jesuit school in Bogota, from which Father Philip Potter comes in exile to Mexico.
So you like to pick up characters from other books and include them in? Is it because they just don't die in your head?
Are they
convenient to revive?
You know, besides, I'm a good reader of Balzac, who had the eternal return of characters. Balzac characters appear in many novels, and William Faulkner's as well. So when you write these sagas, which take in a society, a country, many eras, it's comfortable in a way, but interesting creatively, to have characters reappear from time to time.
You're 82. These characters are in their 20s.
Right, yeah. I have to imagine a lot, you see.
That's like the question is kind of that, like the question that people ask writers about creating women characters, male writers writing women characters, women writing male characters.
Yeah.
Is it that much of a stretch of the imagination?
It isn't because you have experience for the writing. I mean, Gustave Flaubert was not a woman. He wrote Madame Bovary. So it's immaterial. It's your imagination, as it were, not your biography. Or in a sense, my imagination plus your autobiography. But the thing is, an older writer can write about younger people. Younger people can write about older people. I wrote about Artemio Cruz, who was dying in his bed in his 80s when I was in my 20s. So that is, what should I call it, the power of the imagination, simply.
And the response has been fabulous. The reviews have been just great.
They've been pretty good, they tell me.
In Mexico as well, or are you more appreciated in this country?
I think I'm more appreciated in the world than in my own country. Because in my own country, I'm a controversial figure because I have enemies, because the literary criticism is very bad. So I have to wait a bit and see what the response is in the United States, in France, in Germany, in Italy, other countries where I get much better reviews than in my own country because I'm not controversial here.
You're not controversial.
No, I'm a very meek and wonderful man in this country.
You won the Cervantes Prize for this novel.
Yeah.
When was it published originally?
This novel was published 2.5 years ago.
And does it take that?
La Fortuna. Yeah.
Does it take that long to get?
Yes. Good translation takes about a year, and Edith Grossman is the best. I mean, to have a woman who's translated Cervantes translate me is an honor. She's very, very good, but she takes her time, is very punctual, very punctilious even, and she does a great translation. So I'm very happy that what you have is a well-translated book. Doesn't matter when it comes out. 2 years after it appeared in Mexico, that has no consequence because the book is now in English and a very good translation.
The reason I ask is there is a concern that we're seeing fewer translations into English these days.
That is right.
And it took Roberto Bolaño dying to gain him any attention, despite the fact that he's such a great writer.
But when I was a younger man, it was published by Forrest Strauss. And Roger Strauss made a point of publishing. He published Sela, he published Mauriac, he published the Italian writers, he published the Spanish writers. It was really a very, very internationally oriented literature, not the same. So now this is sort of disappeared. You get very, very few foreign writers being published in the United States, which worries me. Maybe you have an answer for that, but it used to be very different.
I'll tell you some other time because I've run out of time, unfortunately.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
I want everyone to know that you'll be giving a talk tonight at the 92nd Street at 8 o'clock. For tickets and more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you, Carlos. Carlos Fuentes, Destiny and Desire, his latest novel, translated by Edith Grossman, published by Random House.